Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Tierra Curry and Lorianne Bird. Tierra Curry is a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, where she focuses on gaining protections for imperiled species in our habitats. She's a lead author on the scientific petition filed this year seeking Endangered Species Act protection for monarch butterflies. Lorianne Bird is Endangered Species Campaign Director and an attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. She's been working on issues of biodiversity and pesticide use over a dozen years and recently authored a successful petition to get GE crops and bee-killing pesticides banned in our 150 million acre National Wildlife Refuge system. So first off, thank you both for your really important work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having us on.
So can we start by talking about I would like to talk mainly about monarch butterflies, but we can also expand that. And can we start, before talking about what's going on with them, can we talk about how they were? Like, we hear about 60 million bison. Do we know, I'm not asking for numbers, but how common were monarch butterflies before these problems?
Well, we didn't actually start counting monarch butterflies until the early 1990s. So what we do know is that in the mid-1990s, there were a billion monarch butterflies. And historically, there were probably several billion butterflies. It's just that we don't have counts from, you know, the historical data. But one of the amazing things about monarchs is that even though they're born in summer in the United States and Canada, all of the eastern population flies to this small forest in central Mexico in the mountains to overwinter. And so when the monarchs are there clustered on the trees in the winter, that's when scientists try to estimate their population size. And so we have a count for the overwintering eastern population since the early 1990s. And so that's how we know that monarchs have declined by more than 90%, because in the mid-1990s, there were a billion monarchs, and last winter, there were only 33 million.
And one of the things that monarch butterflies are known for is this migration, but can you talk just a little bit more about the migration in case there are, you know, three people on the planet who still don't know about it?
Sure. The migration is truly amazing because it is a multi-generational migration. So monarchs, they all go to Mexico for the winter, and then they fly north to Texas and the Gulf Coast states, and they breed. And those monarchs only live for a couple weeks, and they fly north, and then they breed, and those monarchs live for a couple weeks. And then the third or fourth generation that's born in summer, those monarchs fly from the northern United States and Canada all the way back to Mexico, even though they've never been to Mexico. So they fly 2,000 miles to get to this forest that they've never been to, but where their great-great-great-grandparents spent the winter. So it's absolutely amazing, and it's one of the things that scientists don't understand, how they figure out how to get exactly back to where their great-great-great-grandparents were.
And something that always I find extraordinary, given this culture's assault on everything, is that I can understand how there might be some very small creatures who live in a very small range who can survive, but migratory songbirds blow me away because at any step of the way, I'm going to switch metaphors here, if there's any link in the migratory chain that gets destroyed in terms of habitat, the weakest place will be the bottleneck that could destroy them. And it's the same with monarch butterflies, too, that at what this means is that at every step of the way, any threat could then really harm them.
That's right, and that's why we're concerned, even though there's still more than 30 million monarchs, it's because they need a huge population size to be able to successfully complete the migration, because they are so vulnerable, especially to weather. Monarchs are very temperature sensitive, so if it's too hot, the caterpillars just die, and that is of concern because of global climate change. A lot of the southern United States is expected to become too hot for monarch butterflies to be able to reproduce successfully. And then in Mexico, they all go to the mountains, to the small area of forest, and winter storms can kill millions of them. A single winter storm killed 500 million monarch butterflies back in 2002, and that's 17 times the size of the current population. And so, as you say, with migratory songbirds, anywhere along the way, a variety of threats can kill very large numbers of monarchs.
So what are some of the threats to monarchs at every I don't know where you want to start or how you want to handle it, but what are some of their threats?
Well, the biggest threat used to be logging of their habitat in Mexico. And Mexico has made protecting the monarchs a priority, and they've backed it up with law enforcement, and they've also put these programs in place to help people who live near the Monarch Biosphere Reserve make a living without having to log the woods. And so Mexico has really gotten logging under control, and that used to be the biggest threat, and now it's not even considered to be a major threat because of the level of enforcement and working with the communities that's taking place now. Now the biggest threat is genetically modified herbicide-resistant crops in the monarch summer breeding range in the United States. And that's the biggest threat because we are spraying more glyphosate. Glyphosate is an herbicide. It's often marketed as Roundup. And so these crops that are genetically modified to be resistant to it allow us to spray more of it over a longer time period and more times during the growing season. And so that eliminates milkweed. And milkweed is the only plant that monarch caterpillars will eat. And so increasing pesticide use and loss of milkweed is now the biggest threat to monarch butterflies.
And I was talking to somebody a few weeks ago about, I don't remember the name of the program, but it was a very successful agricultural subsidy program where they would, was it conservation, where they would pay farmers to set aside land. And that program has changed such that a lot of the set-aside lands are now being plowed under. Is this?
Right. The Conservation Reserve Program
paid
farmers to keep their land fallow, but with the demand for biofuels has driven up the price of corn. And so we've lost a lot of that conservation land, and it's been planted with corn to produce biofuel, and not just corn, but genetically modified Roundup-resistant corn. So we've lost milkweed in those areas as well.
And so so far you've said logging used to be a threat, genetically modified organisms are a threat, loss of habitat's a threat. What other threats are they facing?
Genetically modified crops in conjunction with increased pesticide use is the threat. And then there's this new group of pesticides called neonicotinoids, and there's a systemic pesticide, and we don't know exactly what threat they pose to monarchs, but we know that they're toxic to a lot of pollinators and especially bees. And then there are newly proposed genetically modified crops that are going to be coming onto the market, and they are going to be modified to be resistant to pesticides that are really prone to drift. And so the drift of these pesticides into fields adjacent to agricultural lands is going to reduce the flowers that monarchs feed on, that the adult butterflies feed on. They have to put on, you know, a certain amount of weight in order to survive the winter. And so they're going to lose important nectaring habitat with this new generation of pesticides. And Lorianne knows all about those. I'm going to let her jump in here and talk about neonicotinoids.
That would be great.
Did you want to follow up on the threats? And we could talk about climate change also, or we can continue talking about pesticides.
Why don't you do both in either order?
Well, I'll stay on the pesticide subject. So I think, you know, a lot of times when people are talking about GE crops, they're talking about sort of these philosophical issues with what it means to alter the genetics of the seed. Where they talk about potential health risks. And when we're talking about GE crops, we're really talking specifically about the environmental impacts. In this case, the proliferation of GE crops and the widespread adoption of them has led to this indiscriminate spraying of Roundup or glyphosate that's increased the amount of Roundup in our environment. It's a 20-fold increase in our environment. So it's a massive, massive increase in glyphosate. And so now we have glyphosate in every stream in the Midwest, and it's just incredibly heavily used, which has these secondary effects, like completely wiping out milkweed. Another thing that's happening is that almost all of our commercial seeds are now treated with neonicotinoids, or we often call them neonics. And neonics are a systemic insecticide that's very persistent in the environment. So what happens is that they're used prophylactically even if there's no major insect risk or issue going on that year, all the seeds that are planted in a particular, well, a vast majority of seeds, we think around 94% of corn seeds, a huge percentage of canola, wheat, and other main commercial crops are now treated with neonics, which means that each seed is dipped in this insecticidal treatment, and then when it's planted, we'll see massive die-offs of pollinators because during planting, the dust that is emitted when they put talc on the seeds to keep them from sticking together during the planting process will get into the environment and will poison huge numbers of pollinators, and that's when we hear about the huge bee die-off happening. We don't have any specific studies on monarchs yet. There's a huge amount of data coming out on the effects of neonics on birds, aquatic invertebrates, and all kinds of other critters. We don't know specifically about monarchs. We know they're definitely having negative effects on other butterflies, and so we're very concerned about that. And in addition to the direct mortality that happens when a species is just poisoned and dies, which is what we hear a lot with colony collapse disorder, there's the sublethal effects, or the delayed mortality, we like to call it. And that's when the creature, whatever it is, the bumblebee or the butterfly, is exposed to neonics, but not in a lethal dose. And it'll have impacts on its central nervous system. And so those effects can be things like decreased ability to forage, a loss of sense of direction. So oftentimes bees just don't come home, and then they die out in the elements. And effects like that, which we're very concerned about how those types of sublethal effects could impact monarchs, because they, of course, have this massive 2,000-mile migration, and if we know that bumblebees aren't able to make it back to their hives that might just be 50 feet away, we are very concerned that it would have significant impacts on that huge migration.
So a couple things. One is that I just got back from a conference called, or a public event called Earth at Risk, and two things about that. One of them is that while I was there, I think it was Vandana Shiva, but it might have been someone else who was there, who was talking about, might have been Dick Manning, talking about how Roundup also is being found to cause lesions in human brains. And so I'm just thinking about this in terms of what you said about the central nervous system. But obviously it is detrimental to nervous system, central nervous systems, no matter who you are. And the second thing, and you don't need to comment on this if you don't want, or if you do, you can run with it, that the audience is about 500 or 600 people, and at one point I asked the audience, do you think this culture has a death urge? And almost everybody raised their hand. And I mean, I just can't get over, and I know that we're supposed to be talking about monarch butterflies, but I can't get over how ubiquitous and how incessant the assault on every living being is. It's just, you know, I've written 20 books about this, and it still blows me away how I still am stunned anew at how they're just killing everything. I mean, what a crazy idea to put persistent nerve to put persistent poisons into the ground, sea, water, air. It's just who would actually poison and put poisons on your own food? It's all nuts.
It's true, and it's incredibly short-sighted. And the issue, so glyphosate or Roundup isn't a neonicotinoid. So glyphosate we are using everywhere, and atrazine we're using everywhere, and then these neonicotinoids are a new class of pesticides that are increasing in use. And so we're just putting poison on top of poison on top of poison, and we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be.
And we also don't understand how those poisons interact with each other, and we have some preliminary studies that are showing that they're that they're interacting synergistically and are even more toxic when they're interacting with each other in the environment. But, you know, one of the things with neonics is that, you know, talking about this widespread destruction is that a lot of people aren't even aware that most of our seeds are treated with neonics. And one awful thing that's happened in the past couple of years is that stores like a lot of the large nursery stores like Home Depot have been selling these plants, and they're selling them as pollinator-friendly, but in reality they have been treated with neonics, and so these plants that are specifically attracting pollinators have been killing them because they've been treated with neonics, and people just don't really know about it. So one of the big things that we've been doing is this awareness campaign, and we've had campaigns against Lowe's and other retailers of plants that people are buying for their homes to let them know that we don't want neonics in those plants. Another thing that's happened was that you mentioned earlier that I wrote a petition to Fish and Wildlife Service that and we had the wonderful result of having them ban neonics and GE crops on national wildlife refuges. My sense from that, and I don't know for sure, but my sense is no, that the corn seeds that were being planted on their refuges were treated with these toxic insecticides. That's just kind of how corn is sold these days. And so once people kind of gain this awareness of what this is, then we're at least giving them the opportunity to make decisions about it. Because really my sense is that they had no idea about neonicotinoid seed treatments. And now we're also finding that these seed treatments aren't actually effective. So there's just a new study released by the federal government a couple weeks ago that showed that they had no significant impacts on soybean yields. So we're poisoning vast acreage, and we're not even getting any supposedly positive effects for farmers.
And most people don't even know what's going on. Like, one of the solutions to try to help save monarchs is for individuals to plant milkweed. And so, you know, a lot of people really want to help. And so they're like, great, I'm going to plant milkweed. And they go down to Home Depot to buy milkweed. And it could have been treated with neonicotinoids, which are going to, you know, kill the things that come to feed on it. And also, a lot of people are planting non-native milkweeds now. And so we're going to, you know, we're interfering with the distribution of native milkweeds. There's a lot of different milkweeds, and they vary by region. And so it's important for people who do want to plant milkweed to save monarchs to make sure that the milkweed they're planting is native to their region, and to also make sure it hasn't been treated with neonics. It puts the burden on the consumer when it should be, like, the retailer should only be offering native ones that aren't poisoned.
Well, and my understanding is that a lot of the people who are planting the milkweed is specifically, like you just said, pollinator attractive. And it's like, why would you, I mean, I guess from their perspective, I can kind of see why you might plant a neonic treated, I don't know, something. But if it's specifically for pollinators, why would you plant a seed that is infused with pesticide when you're doing it specifically for pollinators? That's nuts.
Well, that's the thing is, neonic seed treatments have sort of sprung up and become so widespread that a lot of people just didn't know about it at all. And so I think now that we're starting to see studies coming out showing that they don't even work for farmers that might, you know, be interested in having insecticides, and that people have been inadvertently poisoning all these pollinators that they've been trying to attract because they've been hearing about this, I think my hope is that we'll be able to head off some of this assault. So we've been seeing cities start to ban neonics. Ontario is the first state in North America that's taken significant action to restrict them. Just yesterday, they passed pretty significant restrictions that make it seem like they're on the path towards banning them. And the European Union actually banned them. They promulgated a 2-year moratorium that we're halfway through to allow pollinator populations to start coming back with great results.
And so expanding this a little bit to, and I'm sorry if this is not so much your area of expertise, but I've noticed here, I live in Northern California, and 15 years ago when I moved in, I would routinely all through the summer see groups of hundreds of tiny blue butterflies, and they're pretty much gone. And I know people all over the country are talking about the collapse, not just of bees, but of butterflies too, and moths. And do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah,
I mean, it's not just the monarch is the point.
Right. It's pollinators have taken a huge hit in the last 5 to 10 years, but also a study came out a couple months ago saying that invertebrates across the globe have been wiped out by half over the last 40 years. And there was a similar study saying that the number of vertebrates, not species, but number of individual vertebrates in population has also declined by 50% over the last 40 years. And so basically, as humans, you know, make more humans and buy stuff and go about our daily lives, we've wiped out half of the living beings on the planet, with, you know, invertebrates taking a particularly hard hit. The invertebrate study was in terms of the number of species, and the vertebrate study was in terms of the number of individuals.
Well, something I've been noticing for decades now is that I never clean my windshield anymore, in terms of dead bugs. And I know that in the UK, they actually use license plates. Do you know about this? They use license plates to study insects, that they will basically check the number of insects on the license plates and use that as a really rough estimate of the, you know, number of insects who are around. And insect populations are collapsing. I've noticed even locally, too, that even non-migratory insect population. I live on 40 acres of second growth forest, and I protect it. There's no, you know, nothing even remotely toxic here. But even creatures who have a very small range, like, for example, daddy longlegs, even those, when I moved here, daddy longlegs in the winter will collect in a group maybe the size of a dinner plate and maybe an inch or two thick, and they'll just hang there together through much of the winter. And I think the last one of those collections I saw was maybe 3 years ago. And now I will still see individuals out in the forest, but I haven't seen a single community of them. It's very scary to me.
It's really scary, and it's really sad. You know, I grew up in Kentucky in the southeast, and there were lightning bugs everywhere. Like, chasing lightning bugs is one of my favorite childhood memories. And we've paved so much and sprayed so much that even lightning bug populations are collapsing now. And it just breaks my heart to think that, you know, in 50 years we might be living in a world where children don't have lightning bugs or monarch butterflies. It's really sad.
So what, I know this is a bit early in the conversation to talk about this because we're only about halfway through, but what can be done for butterflies and for monarchs? And let's not yet talk about what individuals can do, but what, okay, if they made you two the czars or queens of all things monarch butterfly, okay, what you can't do is you can't bring down industrial civilization. And we'll save that for tomorrow.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Okay, because what I'm trying – yes, we could talk about that, too.
We can do whatever we want, right?
Yeah.
What about industrial agriculture?
Well, yeah, okay. Okay, here's the deal. You can get rid of both of those in 3 weeks, you know? But the first question I want to ask you – and, yes, actually, let's address that in a minute. But and thank you for saying that. I'm so glad to hear this. But the first thing I want to ask is, within this system, we're going to talk. We can take out the system in a little while. But within the system, what would you do if you could do executive orders? And you, once again, you can't do an executive order dismantling capitalism yet or patriarchy, you know. But what you can do is, what would you do? Like, okay, so what you can do is you can ban Roundup. So what would you do to save the monarchs within the system currently? If you're in charge.
We can ban pesticides?
Okay, we'll make that next week. So first, you can't do that quite yet. So just within the current structure, what would you do?
Current structure. I would put regulations in place so that pesticides are guilty until they're proven innocent. I mean, right now they're just largely thrown out there without us knowing what the long-term effects are going to be. And I would put the burden of proof on the manufacturer to prove that their insecticides and pesticides aren't going to harm things, accumulate in the water table, have long-term effects, cause breast cancer, all of these things, like more of the precautionary principle. And then the other thing that we haven't talked about yet that is driving the decline of monarchs and other pollinators is just development and sprawl. Monarchs have lost an area of habitat about the size of Texas over the last decade to pesticides, but also to pavement and sprawl and malls and subdivisions. And so we really need smarter growth policies in this country to rein in all of the paving and spraying.
And what about you? What would you do?
On pesticide policy, I think we really, really need to get a grip on what's going on. I would just reiterate that. Something like Roundup that's sprayed across millions of acres and millions of pounds, I think 200 million pounds of Roundup are sprayed each year in America. EPA hasn't actually given it a thorough review in decades, and so we really need to take a look at what we're doing with our pesticide policy and really bring that in. I think we should also fight really hard against the next generation of GE crops. The 2,4-D crops that Tira mentioned earlier, those are engineered to be resistant to both glyphosate and 2,4-D, which is one of the active ingredients in Agent Orange. That has just been approved. We are going to be suing over it. We've gotten started on that process. We need to fight like hell to make sure that those approvals don't go through and that next generation of GE crops does not get approved. We already are seeing what's happening with just Roundup Ready crops. So crops that are resistant to Roundup Ready and 2,4-D mean an explosion of 2,4-D use. And we don't actually really know anything about the interaction of 2,4-D and glyphosate in our environment. So that's really something to watch closely. And all the other next generation GE crops like the dicamba glyphosate resistant ones are next down the pipe. So definitely rein that in.
So, I think that we need really long-term studies, not just on, the species. We need those, of course, but also human health effects. I'm not saying at all that, we know that pesticides are linked to autism, but we're looking at now, like, 1 in 70 American kids has autism, and that's not just due to, more diagnosis of it. It's just that it's become so much more prevalent. And I mean, I personally think that there's got to be some environmental change that has caused that increase. And pesticides could be related to that, or it could be some other chemical that we've put out there. I mean, we just don't know. And so we're changing people's lives and like people's potential by dumping so many chemicals into the environment without having any idea at all of their long-term effects.
Something that keeps just stunning me is that, we humans, so many humans seem to consider ourselves the smartest species around. And it just doesn't seem very smart to me to be intentionally bathing the world in nerve agents and endocrine disruptors. That doesn't seem like to me that it's a very that just doesn't seem very smart to me.
It's not very smart. Humans, the planet's been here for about 6 billion years, and humans have been here for 250,000 years. And in 250,000 years, we've changed the entire planet. Like, because of us, all coral reefs are going to bite it within the next 50 years. Scientists are now calling this the Anthropocene epoch because we've changed the entire planet so much. And really, we don't understand that it's our own boat we're talking about here. We're changing things so much that we're jeopardizing the survival of our own species without even having that conversation.
So let's dive back into the cesspool that is this system, and how. What would you want to do how could we help to, not we individuals yet, but how can the precautionary principle How could you even remotely foresee that happening, given the power of Monsanto et al? How could you even remotely see that happening? Is there any way to actually bring that about, to bring that level of sanity about, to somehow institute a precautionary principle associated with these horrible toxic chemicals?
I mean, we have to use the tools available to us, which is our current suite of environmental laws. I think a lot of people think that we are in this green era where people are really considering the environment, but the reality is we have not had any new substantive environmental laws in over 40 years. So we're dealing with these laws that have been around for a really long time, and they are the tools we have in the toolbox. So the law that regulates pesticides, FIFRA, is antiquated, clunky, very difficult to work with, and it makes it really, really hard to get a full evaluation of effects of pesticides on the environment, on human health. The rigor of testing required for registration under FIFRA leaves a lot to be inspired, but it's what we have, and so we have to use it. Of course, I'm biased as an attorney to think that we need to use the laws that we have, but we've had great success. So we know that it's because of advocacy groups and environmental efforts of conservationists that we have been able to really do anything about our extinction crisis. So it's easy to talk about the biodiversity crisis. It's harder to recognize how personal it is. You mentioned the butterflies that you used to see so many of, but the reality is that it would be much, much worse if we weren't fighting like hell, and if there wasn't a community of people that are doing so much, using the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and whatever we have, which are imperfect tools, but they are the tools we have, and we have been able to use them to some good effect.
At the same time, we need to fight for new tools.
Yeah.
You know? And then underlying this whole conversation is just human population growth. We're adding so many humans to the planet, and so we need to have, you know, real sex education and family planning and get rid of those taboos and have real conversations in this country. And also, you know, really fund, like even here in the United States, more than half of all pregnancies are unplanned. And so rampant human population growth is driving all of these problems, and we need to address that here and internationally.
That's actually true across the entire world. More than half the children are unwanted all over the world. And so, yeah, there's actually a really, really easy solution to overpopulation, which is to grant women across the globe absolute reproductive freedom. That would take care of that problem in 3 seconds.
Okay, so, as czar, I'm going to do that too.
Okay. Well,
and we know that women have, you know, drastically fewer children if they have access to education, and so educating women, just providing them with basic education, not just about reproductive health, but about everything, makes a huge difference in population growth.
Yeah, the single largest thing that reduces the number of children is teaching little girls to read. That level of empowerment is really the start. So basically all we need to do with that is take on the main patriarchal religions. I think we should be able to do that by next week.
Thanksgiving is a great day to start that.
Yeah. So that's a hugely important point. And now let's go back to, do you want to, you mentioned sort of jokingly a swipe at industrial agriculture. Do you want to take a more serious swipe at it?
Oh, I'm not joking. We have to take on industrial agriculture. The amount of crop conversion, I think a lot of people think that industrial ag has sort of already done its deed, but we continue, as you mentioned earlier, to convert huge amounts of land in conservation use now to cropland for biofuels and other uses, also to feed our insatiable appetite for meat. Wildlife habitat is disappearing at an alarming rate, and a lot of people think that, you know, all the cropland that's available has already been turned into cropland. But between 2006 and 2011, 530,000 hectares of grassland and wetland were converted to corn and soy fields. So we're still seeing the massive conversion of wildlands into croplands. And that's ongoing as we continue to have an insatiable appetite for these kinds of heavily industrialized fuel crops for fuel. And also a lot of these crops are for feed. So our organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, also started a recent campaign called Take Extinction Off Your Plate, and you can look it up at takeextinctionoffyourplate.org, which is addressing the fact that meat consumption is driving the extinction of so many species because it's driving the conversion of all this wildland to cropland. And then when we have these lands converted to cropland for things like corn and soy, what we can expect is that the corn and soy are genetically engineered primarily to withstand doses of pesticides that would kill any other crop. So what Roundup Ready or glyphosate tolerant or herbicide tolerant means is just that you can drench a plant with a quantity of pesticide that would kill any other plant, but this is engineered not to. So when you convert that land, you're also exposing it to massive doses of pesticides, and then, like we mentioned earlier, most of those seeds are also treated with neonicotinoids. So you're really making that land, in many ways, a dead zone for wildlife, and we need to address that. We need to really, really curb our chemical use. We need to, like I said, make sure that we don't have any new genetically engineered crops come out. We need to address our use of glyphosate very seriously. One long anticipated effect of so much glyphosate use is that weeds have become tolerant to glyphosate. So now we have 43 million acres in the U.S. of land that are infested with herbicide tolerant weeds, which means they can't be killed with glyphosate, which is the most commonly used tool. And so then we start using things like atrazine and 2,4-D, which are even more toxic. So we have to get off that kind of hamster wheel of relying so much on these toxic chemicals and then having to rely on even more toxic chemicals to get ourselves out of the mess that we made by relying on toxic chemicals. There is so much goodness happening in the world of traditional agriculture. It's happening in the world of traditional plant breeding. You know, we've gotten really, really, really far with conventional plant breeding and organic tactics for plant breeding. We can do a lot with that, and those tactics are not supported by the biotech industry because there's no money to be made on patents. But if we could establish mechanisms to encourage that kind of agriculture, we'd really go a long way towards protecting monarchs and all other species.
And Big Ag has done an amazing job of lifting the farmer up to this mythical, untouchable level. One of the things that I've experienced since we submitted the petition seeking Endangered Species Act protection for the monarch is that people get mad and say that we're trying to hurt farmers or we're trying to make it harder for farmers to earn a living. And we're not talking about the small farmer here that, you know, everyone has a fondness for. We're talking about multi-million dollar corporations that are gobbling up land, or even like investment firms are now buying land and planting corn to turn over a quick profit. So we're talking about Big Ag here, and that's what's having, you know, the terrible effect on the planet. But Big Ag is, they're selling themselves as the small farmers, you know, so in most people's minds, There's a difference between Big Ag and your local small farmer, and anyone that is trying to interfere with Big Ag is also, you know, we have to take back, we have to get it clear who Big Ag is here, and that it's not, you know, your small farmer's market farmer.
Well, yeah, and I would say the same thing actually about meat production, that the problem is not actually the meat. Because you can do some amazing things with grass-fed beef and pigs, with improving soil, et cetera, et cetera. And that it's the same thing, that the problem is the industrial model. And the problem is also capitalism. I remember years ago I was at this conference of about, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe 100, 150 of us about sustainable agriculture. And at one point we're in this little breakout session, and it's, you know, me and a few other environmentalists and a lot of really small farmers. And at one point I said, now, I'm not saying that we need to actually overthrow capitalism. You know, I don't know what was wrong with me to say we didn't need to overthrow it. But anyway, I said, I don't know, I'm not saying that. And it was great because immediately a half dozen people, including this one old classic-looking farmer, even wearing overalls, they all shot their hands up in the air and said, I'll say it. And the problem is not the small farmers, and I've known this for chicken farmers, you know, very small-scale chicken farmers, they're all being driven out of business, just like – and it's the same thing. I was just talking to Vandana Shiva about this. This is the same thing over in India. It's the same thing all over the world. There are these massive land grabs by these huge agri corporations.
Yeah, and it's like our corn and soy policy, it's affecting other countries. Like Mexican farmers can't sell their corn anymore, and so they're being driven into poverty by our big ag corn. It's really sad.
So we have just a few minutes left, and what would you, what can people either in the United States, most of the listeners are going to be from the U.S. and Canada, so let's go with that first, and let's go back to the monarch butterflies. The purpose of this radio program is to get people off their behinds and doing something. So what do you want people to do?
Something that people can do on their behinds is go to our website, biologicaldiversity.org, and go to the Monarch webpage on there. And there's a petition that people can sign in support of adding the Monarch to the endangered species list. This summer, the Center for Biological Diversity with the Center for Food Safety, the Xerces Society, and Dr. Lincoln Brower submitted a petition to try to get the Monarch protected as an endangered species. And there's a lot of opposition to that petition from agriculture, from Monsanto, from butterfly breeders. And so we need individuals to go sign that petition because we're going to submit it to Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's on our webpage. And then people can choose to eat corn and soy that aren't genetically modified and that are organic. And then the other thing people can do is plant milkweed that's native to their region and that hasn't been treated with pesticides.
And wait, did you just say butterfly breeders? What is that?
People who sell butterflies for a living, like if you were going to get married or have a graduation or a funeral, you can go online and order butterflies, and they'll send these adult butterflies to you that are like one butterfly per envelope. And you pass them out to your guests, and then at the magic moment, all the guests release the butterflies into the air. And so the people that make a lot of money selling butterflies are opposed to, because they sell monarchs and painted ladies, they're opposed to the monarch being protected.
Wait, so they you can release these in Hawaii, or you can release them in you can release them where the monarchs don't live. So basically, it might look pretty for a couple seconds, but basically, you may as well just have smashed the envelope. You've just killed these creatures, right?
And you also spread any disease that they're carrying to the local butterfly population.
This is horrible. I've never heard of this. This is dreadful.
Yeah, Google butterfly release. It makes me super sad.
It's also a big issue with commercial bee rearing. They give a lot of native bees diseases that way by transporting commercial bees across the nation.
Yeah, that's a I used to be a commercial beekeeper actually, and I wrote something years and years, gosh, for the New York Times Magazine, just 25 years ago about how, or 20 years ago about how the movement of colonies of bees across the country is just a complete recipe for disaster.
I wrote a petition asking to stop that movement, I think, in 2009, and we're still waiting on USDA to take action on that. So really it's very important when folks hear about opportunities to support petitions and to support the actions of folks that are really trying to make change. I strongly encourage people to take those opportunities. Our agencies need to hear from people and know that there's a lot of pressure to address these issues.
So what else can people do apart from that petition?
People can start screaming. I mean, the people who realize what's going on need to make as much noise as we can about it, using social media, talking to people with consumer choices. We just, it's like the flap of a butterfly's wings. That affects everything that we do makes a difference, and we need to tell as many people as we can about it. And I think we also have to remain optimistic. We have to feel empowered that we can make a difference. We have to avoid despair and believe that we can affect positive change and that change is possible.
And is there anything else that you would like to let listeners know about either monarch butterflies or pollinators in general?
Just that people's support really matters. Like the Center for Biological Diversity, most of our funding is from individuals who believe in what we do. And so how individuals spend their dollars and donate their dollars and the food decisions they make really does have an impact.
We spend a lot of our time fighting on behalf of species that no one's really thinking about. And so you hear a lot about bees, but you don't hear a lot about all the many little butterflies that we're constantly advocating on behalf of, the butterflies that have populations of just a couple dozen left. And we work on all those little species, and we really do appreciate people supporting our work in whatever way possible, whether it's finding things or chipping in. Whatever they can do, you know, going into your local nursery and asking whether the plants are treated with neonics can start a conversation with that nursery owner. They might not know so much about neonics. So those are all things that people can do in their day-to-day lives.
And people can vote, too. Here in Portland, well, in Oregon, we just had this ballot measure to label GMO crops, and right now it's behind by 800 votes. And so that's like one where every single person's vote really did matter.
Well, thank you both so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Tierra Curry and Lori Ann Bird. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.